Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Thanks for joining us for Love What You Play, our online event where I've had an opportunity to talk to some amazing people across the world. Our next guest is one of those top sports leaders that I'm so looking forward to have a conversation with. John Kessel, who is the Director of Sports Development for USA Volleyball. And the list of hats he wears after that are so numerous that we've added them in our bio page. But to say that he's been coaching for a wee bit and he's got a little bit of experience would be a little bit of an understatement. I'm so looking forward to having a chat and looking forward to this, John. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. And thanks for taking the time to make this all happen. All I have to do is sort of think and talk. But I think the fact that I've been coaching for almost 50 years is almost a misnomer. What I really love to do is coach coaches. You know, most of my peers, Russ Rose, Jim Stone, Doug Beal, you know, they went on to coach the teams like Penn State and, you know, all these great titles. And I made this sort of decision in the late 70s, early 80s to branch away from coaching kids, although I do summer camps and I just did two 13-year-old teams this year, but mostly to do the coaching of coaches. Because, you know, you go, hey, you coach these kids, who coaches you? And in the vast majority of coaches' case, they go, nobody. So that's how I find myself, you know, doing that. And also, Glenn, breaking out of the silos. You know, we live in a volleyball silo too much, and team sports have unique properties that are principles shared across them. So I have worked with the NHL and USA Hockey, and I've worked with US Lacrosse, and I've worked with Major League Baseball and, you know, USA Basketball, because they're doing team things that have similar principles, and they come up with great ideas that if you live in your own volleyball silo, you never find out about what they're doing on the other side.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's same kind of path, nowhere near the tenure, but after 20 years of, you know, coaching kids in a whole bunch of different sports, hockey being one of them, baseball, football, a whole bunch, rugby, whatever. My path, similar to when I started mentoring and doing clinics, as like that's where I really found my love and passion. And I asked the same question, you know, do you have a mentor? And 90% of coaches kind of look at me like deer in headlights, mentor? Like, no, I mean, I'm just doing my thing. And said, well, you know, how are you going to become better as a coach so that you can help your players become better? Mm-hmm. You've got to get a mentor and you've got to continue developing. And in our space in Canada, the Coach Association of Canada does have required maintenance points and professional development that you have to do. Mm-hmm. So it is something that helps them grow, but unless they go digging for it, they don't really become better as coaches, which is unfortunate. So talking to someone that's been doing it and with all those different sports is great.
I mean, you just said somebody to go to. I think one of my favorite two words is the words ancora imparo, which means in Italian, always learning. And the story for me hit me from Michelangelo, which is when he was like in his 80s and he's painting and he turned to his crew and he kind of goes, ancora imparo. So if a guy that's maybe the best painter in the history of the world is painting in his 80s and still learning, what does that say about me as a 20-year-old coach? Or do I simply in a closed mindset way sort of close the door and say, I'm going to teach the way I was taught? And that's the breaking point, I think, Glenn, that I get. There are people that go, yes, I'm willing to learn, even though I think I know a lot because I played the game, but now I'm going to start coaching. And it goes again back to those principles of learning. I say that because one of the things that cracks me up the most, if you now go to Google and type in volleyball drill, you'll get
probably 1,000.
Glenn, 32 million choices.
It's like hockey.
Million. So how the hell do you, you know, do the thinking that what is this drill something that has value or not? And most people don't do enough of that thinking. They just copy it and don't know the why that is so important. You know, that whole Emerson quote from the engineer Emerson about, you know, principles are few and methods are many. And if you grasp principles, you're going to be fine. But if you just do methods, you're going to have trouble. And that tied into my belief that the coach who knows why beats the coach who knows how. And not enough coaches ask or struggle or fight through the why. They just do it because they do it, you know, because that's the way I was taught. And I think that that's, you know, it's the player who knows why meets the player who knows how. Because of that, if you really understand that, you won't have kids turning and looking at you on the bench over and over after every play. Mm-hmm. Because you've taught them the why rather than, oh, the only source of answers is my coach. I screwed up. Why? You know, I'm looking at you, coach. And that head turn is what I really work hard to get rid of.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to if they make a mistake and mm-hmm. understanding, okay, I made a mistake and just move on. And encouragement, that kind of comes around. It's not really one of the questions I was anticipated, but growth mindset with Karsh Kuraly is one of the things we've been preaching to stuff like that. Is the ugly mistakes also something that he and or USA Volleyball endorses in gameplay? Or are you kind of like refrained, well, you know, I don't want you making mistakes in games, but really, really push yourselves in practices.
Our game is chaotic. Hockey is pretty chaotic and fast. Lacrosse is pretty chaotic and fast. I don't think there's a sport, though, that's more chaotic in its speed. One of the facts, you know, we love to share facts rather than opinions. So a fact of our sport is that the average Olympian in a match or in the entire tournament of the Olympics touches the ball far less than a minute of total contact time in the entire Olympic Games, not the practice, mm-hmm. the competition. That's partly because in spiking, most people believe in a thing called wrist snap. And I, you know, this is one of the fun areas to kind of delve into, but they think, and I did in the 70s, I took a towel and I wrapped it over the top of a ball and the towel went, hmm. And I said, that's what I want your hand to do so the ball gets the spin. And then the Olympic Committee's biomechanic guys showed me in slow motion that the contact time of the hand on a ball is 1/100 of a second to 1/8000th of a second that the hand is touching the ball.
Wow.
And then after 1/100 of a second, it's no longer being touched. Now your wrist is doing this, I understand, but it's really not what I thought as a young coach, that that's what's making the ball spin. It's the contact point on the sphere, much like a cue ball on a Q-tip, that's making it spin, because the contact time is 1/100 of a second. You can't impart spin in 1/100 of a second. You know, you look at it on in slow motion and you see this occurring. And that fact, rather than an opinion, says, okay, what do I need to do when my ball doesn't have top spin? Well, I need to hit the sphere a little bit higher on the thing, not worries per se about my snapping wrist. Now, people misinterpret that to think that means that we shouldn't snap our wrists. No, because the contact time is so short, the power generated, let alone the spin comes from the contact, but the power generation is like less than 3%. I think it's 2.3%. from the wrist moving forward in that, because in super slow motion, I got a ball here. In super slow motion, what happens is the wrist goes backwards for 2/1000th of a second, backwards, and then it moves forward 6 to 8 thousandth of a second, and then it's no longer being touched. In that kinetic chain whip ending for that 6 thousandth of a second, 2.3% power is generated. Okay, that's power. But it ain't 50% coming from the wrist or anything like that. Well, where does your power come from? Then people say 60% comes from your core. Well, luckily we've got guys at the USOC that have studied it to say, where does the power come from when a person is unsupported in the air, hitting the ball as hard as they can? You know, imagine a baseball player jumping as high as they can and then swinging to see if they could hit a home run. We're kind of doing that. Well, the core only gives 17.7%. Your shoulder torque is 38, and your arm speed, your arm swing, is 42% of the power. Okay, little kid, how do you hit the ball harder? Swing your arm faster?
Yeah.
Well,
how else?
Well, you don't open the door, you slam the door. You don't close the door, you got to slam the door. You got to get that torque while you're up in the air to generate power. Those are the facts. People will say, oh, well, wrist snap really matters. Yeah, 2.3% and where it is, but it's not what I thought that is making the ball spin. You know?
Yeah, I mean, you've learned that all through the tenure and all the years that you've now been coaching with the data, the analytics has now become pretty prevalent in a lot of sports. I mean, baseball's probably, you know, think of the movie Moneyball where they really ramped up analytics. Mm-hmm. Hockey is now starting to, and a great example, what I loved when Bob and Ken did the analytics of the U8 kids, Little Caesars, to promote the benefits of cross-ice hockey.
Yeah.
And we're talking, you talked about the limited amount of time that a competitive athlete at the Olympics touches the ball in volleyball. Well, they did a study in 2002 of the two Canadian teams when we won, both won gold medals, and the average puck time was about a minute 20 of like the best players that we had ever put on the ice and won those two gold medals in a 60-minute game. Mm-hmm. And that was the best player. So then we thought we go backwards in time to like a peewee age kid that's playing at the recreation stream, 8 seconds of puck time you'll have in a game. And so when they did the analytics and showed, you know, number of puck touches, number of shots, passes received, passes attempted, the amount of shots of goalies, like the data and the science was there. But like Canada had, I know they had, when they rolled it out, there was still a lot of pushback from parents. So kind of precursors, one of the questions is the LTAD, and they're setting the bar on ADM, which is a derivative of our long-term. What's USA Volleyball doing on that respect? Because you already touched on some of the things you're doing with the younger kids.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that we're working really hard to teach all our club directors and our member sports organizations. I just spent a long time with the YWCA, which has volleyball programs all over the U.S., last week, and done it for the YMCA. I'm working with the National Police Athletic League to simply the way we get to do it is sort of what basketball's going to get a chance to do it. Basketball's going to get better and grow because in the Olympics, it's now 3-on-3. What we got is doubles. So I would love for every program of 11 and under to never play 6-on-6, to maybe play 4-on-4, but preferably to play triples and doubles. And that's what cross ice is for your sport, and chumash is for lacrosse. And in our sport, you know, anything you learn by doing. My example I often talk about here is my kids watched me drive for 16 years, but did they know how to drive when they started to drive? And the answer is not at all. They might have known how to go, damn it, at the but they didn't know how to drive until they started to drive. And your insurance rates start up at super high level.
Yeah.
The more they drive, as a parent, you watch your insurance rates drop because they become more skilled drivers by driving. But they watched me drive for 16 years, and that had zero impact on their knowing how to ride. To your listeners, I often tell the story about how did you learn to ride a bike? And that's because everybody knows how to ride a bike. And you then ask, okay, did your parents hire a bike riding coach? People die learning how to ride a bike. I have never found a kid dying playing volleyball. I know adults have heart attacks while playing volleyball, but that's not volleyball's fault, if that makes sense. You know, you're just, they're having a heart attack sitting there watching their daughter play too. You know, I mean, that's a health issue, not a volleyball caused issue. But learning how to ride a bike, every year kids get killed learning how to ride a bike because it's dangerous. All right. So did your parents hire a bike riding coach?
No.
Did they send you to bike riding summer camp?
or another? No, never had any of that.
The biggest one is how many, Glenn, how many bike riding drills did you do?
My trial and error with learning the bike, and I'll never forget it. My dad actually put a pair of training wheels on the bike, and I was like 5 years old. I rode it day one. And I didn't know this, and about day five after I started riding it, I'm excited, I'm able to ride the bike. My dad actually took the training wheels, and he was lifting it up like an inch per day. And I didn't, you think you've got that safety net with the training wheels as a kid, but I didn't even have them. So I was actually riding the bike without even knowing it. So it was kind of a great way that he set me up. But learning how to swim was another story itself. Just throw you in a lake and good luck.
Same thing. And thousands of kids drown, and yet you learn to swim by swimming. And, you know, Germany did a really cool study on training wheels because that's kind of a Western civilization creation for safety. And it shows that really slowed the learning down. Your dad did the right thing. Quickly, he got rid of the training wheels and kept you in balance, which is how you really learn to ride a bike in many ways. So there are billions of people that ride a bike in the world, and none of them use training wheels. That's just kind of a, you know, like I say, Western civilization safety thing. But since your dad didn't do any bike riding drills, how can that be? You learn to ride a bike, you know? And that applies in my world, back to your train ugly question about the national team. We know in the chaos, we know that being perfect it's a hustle, as Brené Brown says. You can't be perfect. That's other based. You want to be as good as you can be. Right. And in doing that, you recognize that the ball's flying at really high speeds all over this cube of air above your court and multi-directional, almost that no point is ever the same in volleyball, ever. It's always somehow different. And in that, you got to be comfortable with the chaos and what is ultimately ugly, because you're here and the ball's over here and you have a choice. Let it hit the floor or do something with your body to keep it from hitting the floor. And often that something doesn't look like perfect passing because you're not in the right place and nor the right time. The best example of this, Glenn, that I hope your listeners understand is old John and young John teaching how to spike. When a kid hits it here, and they should hit it at full extension, as every good coach shows, and every player ultimately knows, but they hit it here, down by their ear. Young John Kessel, the coach, teaching the way he was taught and not learning the more effective and efficient ways to teach sport, said the following five things. Reach, extend, get on top of the ball. The negative youngest John Kessel, until my mom straightened me out, said, don't drop your elbow. I now became more positive in my supposed teaching and screamed, keep your elbow up. And I said those probably for 5 or 6 years in the 70s, none of which helped them hit any better. Because if you ask a kid without the ball, how should spiking look? They're going to show you full extension. They're not going to go, it should look like this. You know, well, then the coach that has to know the why goes, well, why are they hitting it here? And the answer is very simple. The ball is there. They are not going to reach full extension and hit it off their elbow in front of their parents and say, happy? No, they're going to put their hand on the ball. That's what humans do in volleyball. We put our hand on the ball. So how do you get the ball to be higher? You got to swing sooner or you got to swing faster. It's not a technical thing. Most people yammer away with technical stuff when the reality is that I'm in the wrong place and or the wrong time. And I got to help guide them to be at the right place and time. Serve reception, Glenn, is the same thing. You and I get really good at partner passing. How good are we at serve receiving? And the answer is we're horrible. Because serve reception, talking to Karch and Misty and every libero on our Olympic team, the big question, how much of your success at receiving the ball to your teammate in doubles or sixes happens before the ball breaks the plane of the net? Out of 100%, how much of your ability to do this has already happened by the time the ball breaks the plane of the net? And every national team player says the same numbers, 80% on floaters and 90% on jumpers. Everybody listening today has to win the serve-serve-receive battle, Olympic and 12-year-old. Yeah, I love hitting. But if you can't win the serve-serve-receive fight, you lose. We lost in 2012. Brazil beat us in the serve-serve-receive battle in the gold medal match. We won the first game way ahead in the serve-serve-receive battle. What was the score of that one? We won 25-11. And then we lost the next three. Because Brazil, we outblocked them. I think we outhit them. But we lost the serve-serve-receive battle. What does that mean? I can't learn to serve-receive from partner passing. I actually learned to get worse. Going brrrr. Because one of the things... Let's preface something here, Glenn, for a big picture concept as we talk. The two most important skills in our sport, one, reading the game, reading the ball flight, reading the opponent, reading the game. Two, learning the game. A friend of mine, Mark, wrote a really good book, Swifter, Higher, Stronger, that said, and spoke of really important stuff, I think, that this is no longer an athletic competition. This is a learning competition. Your project that you're doing is helping coaches be more effective teachers of their kids, or their athletes, if they're not kids, doesn't matter. How do I learn effectively, faster, and more efficiently? I like to say, if I had twins, and I had Glenn and Glenna, the two identical twins, and I said, twin one, do it this way, and the other twin is learning this way. Look at those two. Who's going to get better faster? And if it's this one, then stop doing that one, because I only have so much time. My 1300 program that I did this year, 90 minutes, start to finish. That's all I got. Twice a week, that's 3 hours of learning over the course of a week. You've got to be really effective, way more effective than Karch, perhaps you could say, or Sparaw, or Tom Black for you guys, who Tom is awesome. You're lucky to have him because he understands motor learning really, really well. He understands how do we learn faster. And so he may shake up the apple carts of the way the kids coming up the Canadian pipeline have been taught to, quote, learn effectively. They thought, he's going to say, that's great. That was then. Do you see why this is more effective? So we're not going to do that anymore. You know? And that's hard for some people to change from because they want to keep teaching the way they were taught.
Yeah, that's the analogy in almost every clinic, every interaction I have with coaches is just because this is the way you were coached then doesn't mean this is the way you're going to coach now. And main reason is there's been a wee bit of changes in the whole dynamics of coaching, the mechanics, the technique, you know, just nailed it in terms of limited amount of ball contact and all the different mechanics, the motor learning concept that is, and that was my dream when I was going to university, was I wanted to get into that realm. But unfortunately, when I graduated with a degree of motor control and performance, there was nothing out there. Like, there was literally nobody even recognized it as a profession. And it's kind of ironic, 20 years plus later, okay, now I'm actually interacting with people that are in this space, which is like, and whenever I can hear all the technical. But how can coaches then understand that the technique is one thing, but how to deliver that technique is the key? Because that's where I see the biggest challenges. You know, we talked about it earlier, the how versus the what. Mm-hmm. How can they learn that in a faster period of time instead of, you know, kind of fumbling through the first 10 years of their coaching careers?
Well, and you know, I've got a group of friends that luckily I get a dialogue with this a lot. And, you know, the how versus the why. I mean, I love the poem. I have six friends who serve me true. Their names are who, what, when, why, how, and who, you know, and where, or something. I always ask my questions there. And the why of learning faster is mostly because the vast majority of us only have a very limited amount of time to learn this motor skill. Now, in soccer, you get a pause with the ball. In basketball, when things aren't right, you reach out, grab it, bring it back. And as horrible as the pass may have been, now it's back to okay, and we can, you know, we're okay. But in volleyball, you never get a whole lot of the ball. It's a rebound sport. And the only other rebound sport that I can think of is, my mom used to have a tennis racket that I swear to God it was about this big, and now it's this big. Playing better rebound tennis, but you and I have chosen a volleyball game where you can't buy new setter paddles or new passing arms or the latest whatever. You just play volleyball. I mean, all you get is better shoes and maybe a better pair of knee pads or something. And so when I think of that, my friends talking about this, we had a Cap 3, which is kind of our highest level course in the U.S., and we brought in Doug Beal and said, how many drills do you do with the national team? And his answer was 10 to 12, but I have hundreds of scoring variations. And in my stuff that I put up online, you're only going to see, there's a whole thing called the evolution of drills, where I take a coach-centered passing circle drill where the kids are handing you a ball and you're implementing every ball, so you're getting 50% of the contacts, and evolve it over the course of time to butterfly, which is you're out of the drill and there's two balls flying around. And ultimately, in serve and serve reception, that I think is so important, you can get groups of three, two on each side, four groups on one single net, serving, passing, and targeting. And you've got four balls in the air. Well, you can go over there, and the coach is putting the ball in the air in the first version, so 50% of the contacts are by the coach. The coach doesn't play any volleyball last time I checked, so why the hell is a coach getting any contacts? And that's a different topic alone. Well, my kids can't do it. Yeah, because you're stealing all the contacts, you know? And the USOC researchers study a lot of our sports, and they go, what is it? We didn't know that coach played in volleyball, because we go to basketball and we never see a coach implement any drill, start any drill. We go to football, nothing. We go to soccer, nobody's implementing anything. The coach isn't controlling everything. And we come to volleyball and the coach is getting sometimes half the reps in the gym. Guy, the coach must play a lot of volleyball. And the answer is not when the game is played. It's our tradition, our culture, our history of, I want practice to look good. And that's maybe, Glenn, one of the biggest sentences I ever heard when I was at the USOC in these coaching clinics. Dr. Richard Schmidt, who has passed away sadly in the last few years, but his book, Motor Learning and Performance, Principles to Practice, in the fifth edition, any of the editions, first through whatever, you can find it cheap online. those five editions, he came to the USOC. He listened to our Olympic coaches. They spoke about what they do as drills. And he kept saying, it's not, doesn't have the emotion. It doesn't have the reality. We don't train in reality enough. And he kept saying, and this is the line that still resonates every day in me, most coaches practice for practice and not for performance. They want practice to look good. Your initial question was kind of like, hey, Karch is okay with it being ugly. Yeah, because that's reality. Not practice looks pretty and the game looks ugly. No, they're both really chaotic and fast moving and ugly. And you just have to be comfortable with that. That the technical errors that most coaches fix aren't because of technique. It's because the kid's in the wrong place at the wrong time again. I'm back to that same place. So I only have about a dozen drills. Now, your country is famous to me in the early 80s, as I recall, Bob Bratton wrote two books, 300 plus volleyball drills. And then he wrote another one, 400 plus volleyball drills. And coaches love drills. And if I said, hey, we're going to have a how do you learn faster clinic, I'd get 20 people show up. I'm going to have the top 20 drills ever done in the United States ever, and I'll get 2,000 people to show up. But they're missing the learning part, that we really want it to be as game-like as possible, which starts with the ball going over the net. Last time I checked, Glenn, first ball, every point scored starts with what skill? Let's serve. Okay. Well, how many of your drills start with the serve? And I'm not saying it needs to be 100%. I'm just saying it's not enough. Now, do the kids know this? I think they do, because, and then, before I get to the kids, so the first ball goes over the net, then it gets touched once and goes over a net. Yeah, a net, that's right. Or it touched twice and it goes over a net, or it touched three times and then the third hit must go over this thing that's called a net. Yet in my first years of coaching, I ran in, I set up the court for a half hour, and then we ignored the net. So practice looked good by partner passing, by peppering, by doing all these things that look at all the ball control I have, which has zero value to hitting a ball over the net because there was no net there to tell me that I was right or wrong. And so practice looks good, but it wasn't reality. So the kids, what drill or game in Canada do the kids scream, no, when you go to stop it?
It got me.
I'm saying it's queen of the court. Okay. Or I'm talking to the Canadians, monarch of the court. Okay. In monarch of the court, the kids don't want to stop playing. The coach who knows why beats the coach who knows how. Why do they not want to stop playing? Well, they're playing 3-on-3, which means each of them have a chance to touch it every time the ball crosses the net. When we play 6-on-6, I may not touch the ball. I don't learn. And I learn in queen of the court because I get to touch the ball. Yep. And how to start. If I miss the serve, see ya. That's reality. That's what's going to happen when I play in front of my parents. I miss the serve. We lose the serve. And it's over the net. Oh my God, I'm using the net. What a concept. So every drill should essentially be using the reality of our sport, which is the net. I mean, do basketball players practice their technical form and shooting without a hoop? Yeah. Oh, look at that form. There's no hoop. You're not doing what reality is. And of course, they never do. They always shoot at a hoop.
Yeah, and it's no different really than the argument, practice the way you're going to play.
Yeah, absolutely.
And practice at full speed. A perfect example in the hockey world is Sidney Crosby, and one of the reasons why he's one of the best players that ever played the game. Mm-hmm. Everything for him at the practice environment is at full speed.
Full speed.
And he actually, an interesting story. One of my colleagues actually had Mike Johnson had one of his camps in the summer, and he said that, you know, the Penguins take skills so passionately, they built a separate, like an additional rink, so the Zamboni didn't have to flood the ice. So they just go boom, boom, like a hop off one sheet to the next sheet. And
ooh, that's cool.
Sydney is going at 100%. He tells all the players, I don't want you to make perfect passes to me, because in the game environment in hockey, I don't know, in the NHL, they're a lot more perfect than like at a peewee level or a bantam level. But he wants the pucks in his skates. He wants it way in front of him, because that's kind of the environment. It is the chaos.
It is.
This is the best guy in the world practicing at a level, at a speed and chaotic in moment. That's what made him so good. And people wonder, well, what are they doing in Nova Scotia? Then there's another little guy, another player named McKinnon's pretty good too. And they came out of the same hockey association. So I want to go talk to that coach of the head coach and say, what are you doing differently than the rest of the, or is it probably focusing a lot on the why instead of, you know, the how?
And I bet, you know, when I worked with the NHL guys, I found one of the things fascinating that they, the players love to play 2-on-2 cross ice. That's their queen of the court, their moniker of the court. And why? Well, because they're playing the game and at high speed and trying to beat the other guy, but it's not 5-on-5. It's just you and me against those two others. And that's getting more reps and learning by doing at the NHL level. So in our sport, there's one club that is amazing, in my humble opinion. It's called Outrigger Canoe Club. And if you go to their facility, they have 3 sand courts, one for the adult men, one for the adult women, and then there's the baby court. Out of our program, since the 64 Olympics, 15 Olympians have come out of this one little 125 person per season training volleyball group.
Wow.
15. There are clubs that are, you know, $10,000 a year type clubs that have sent zero. And this one little group, by doing what at the beginning? 2-on-2, playing doubles, getting over the net, reading and experience, and seeing what happens. And when you're lucky, you get invited, because there's only 3 guys on that court. They invite the best kid from the baby court up to play with them until their friend arrives. Now you get to play against adults. Well, I think all the better hockey guys probably really got good in part because they played with older brothers and sisters. And a little kid that's the last kid is the kid that got the best, because they had older brothers and sisters that made them play faster than playing your age group. If I had one little mini wand I'd somehow wave, it would be to convince parents and kids that winning this 9-foot-tall trophy in the 11 and under national championships has slowed down their learning greatly versus playing with adults in doubles or against adults in any way you can, or against older kids any way you can, even though on the outcome side you're going to lose on the scoreboard. I'm losing. But on the process side, I am getting way better. Hockey, lacrosse, volleyball, doesn't matter. Happens in every case.
Yeah, it's because of the whole, I guess, fixation with parents today. It's all outcome-based instead of understanding the importance of the process, right? It's wins and losses. That's their measurement. And you kind of touched on the 11U with the trophies. What's your take on the monetization model, and how bad is it in volleyball? Because in hockey, it's kind of gone insane, and some other sports gone insane. Has it impacted, like, in terms of academies and the pay-to-play model? Is it really prevalent in the volleyball world?
It is very prevalent, both in training and in the tournaments. I'm proud to say that we have these things called qualifiers, because they've open up the sport to so many more kids. When I go to nationals in 77 in Hilo, Hawaii, we got lost trying to find court number 4 in the pineapple field over there, you know, because you were going to gyms that had 1 court or 2 courts. And so a tournament was inherently small based on we only have seven courts in these five gyms to be able to have a tournament. Now, kind of like maybe the pond hockey championships, everything is in one place under one roof. Yeah. And up to 150 courts. And then the other big thing that allows for more learning faster is the wave model, where you play two pools of four rather than one pool of five or a pool of six, which, you know, takes you there all day. You get in the 8-2 wave, or you get in the 3-9 wave, and you get to see the city you're in. You get to, you know, hang out and not play all day. You know, you play ref, left, sit, play, you know, and then you're out of there. But the monetization has really caused the school side of the sport to struggle unless a really smart coach is creating his or her own pipeline mm-hmm. with the school model. So Rebecca Monet, a dear friend, came to my Lifetime Achievement Award thing last week for USA Volleyball. Drove 6 hours from Naya Bay, which is the most northern western part of the continental United States, Macaw Nation tribe. 10 years ago, I came in and did a clinic for her and said, for you to get to state in your school, it's not so much club, it's that you need to go down and start getting the PE teacher in first through sixth grade, having them play doubles. And then when they get to middle school, having them play triples or maybe fours. And then when they show up at your freshman tryout, you know, for the high school team, they'll have all this experience of playing volleyball. Mm-hmm. Well, she did it. And now she's going to state, you know, and her kids are getting scholarships. That starts by getting kids to play and get the reps over the net, small-sided games. All back to that ADM model that I think I'm most impressed with hockey's ADM. Yet you're right. Canada fought. There's still some people in the United States that say, play the real game.
Yeah.
5 year olds on full ice, you know, 5-on-5. What an incredible, inefficient way to learn. Is it wrong? No. Those kids are skating instead of sitting, watching television, eating candy. Well, that's not wrong. I'm glad that those kids are out on that ice. But you, sir, are not as effective of a teacher of hockey when you do this play the real game. You got to go small-sided cross ice. And, you know, there's that NHL analytical study that showed 400% more passes and 300% more shots or whatever. It's on YouTube. You may have already shared it. I don't want to forget, because I'm jumping around here so much, the video I really want people to watch is the backwards bicycle. So maybe you can throw it, edit in the clip or something. But I love it to death because a guy that's been riding a bike for over 30 years and is really good gets on a bike with one change. This is about specificity and learning and, you know, one change. They change the handlebar so when it goes this way, the tire goes that way instead of when you turn it this way and the tire goes that way, like we learned. How long has it taken to learn to ride that bike with that one change? Just at the handlebar, turn and the wheel goes that way, turn the other way, the wheel goes that way. Everything else is the same, the pedals, the wheels, it's the same damn bike, just one gear change.
So it's just turning the handlebars? So yes. If you're turning left, you're going right. If you're turning right, you're going left?
Exactly. How long does it take? And he's ridden a bike for 30 years of his life.
I can't imagine it would take that long. I don't know what it would be in minutes or seconds.
Absolutely. And so he makes a living, as we speak, Glenn, traveling around the world, offering $200 to somebody that can ride the bike 10 feet. And nobody's been able to do it. And he learned to in 8 months before he could ride the bike. Now, his son, human youth, the brain is more plastic, that's more hardwired to learn motor learning and all that. 3 weeks, because he had ridden his other bike, not for many years, you know, but they flipped it on his little bike and it took him 3 weeks to learn.
Why is that? Because I right away I thought it would be, not be very long, because it just, all you're doing is you're reverse. I guess it's when you're kind of doing the hand thing and you're doing right versus left and you're trying to figure that out.
It's
what's the tech?
The balance is different completely. It's not that he doesn't know how to ride a bike. In fact, one of the fascinating parts, it's about a 7-minute video to the end. After 8 months, he goes to Holland or Denmark or something, and he asks for somebody to give him a regular bike, and he couldn't ride it for about 20 minutes. You saw him get on it, and he looked like you and I probably looked our first time. He's wibbling and wobbling, and that's a regular bike that he's riding, but he can't. And all of a sudden, it clicked. Why is that? Specificity in learning. Motor programs, you have been shown to be specifically learned forever, ever since the motor learning researchers ago. Things are learned specifically. Here's another small example. There were some shoes out there for about a decade. Hell, maybe they're still out there, called jump shoes. Remember those? That sold for a couple $100, and they had a platform underneath the toe. And you put your heel down and you had your foot up on a platform, and you got a jump training program that if you followed this jump training program with these jump shoes, you would increase your jump by 2 or more inches or something. Well, that's, and it's all because of the negative heel effect, according to this baloney.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it seems like a gimmick to me, but.
Almost every machine out there is a gimmick that practice looks good.
Yeah.
Buttons. A spike machine where the ball is frozen in place is slowing down the learning. It's not speeding it up. It's just making practice look good. I can hit out of a frozen ball. When will I ever see that in a real game? Never. So the shoes, McGowan took them to BYU and said, 30 pair tested. And they had the control group and the group, and the bottom line of this story is, yes, the people that follow the jump regime of these shoes, having paid $150 or $200 for the shoes, did jump 2 to 4 inches higher. But the people that followed that jump program without the jump shoes jumped even higher because that's how they're going to jump in a game. That's called specificity in learning.
Yeah, because they focus on the mechanics of the jump versus relying on a tool to help them jump.
Sure.
The gimmick. So, yeah. In respect of time, I'm going to jump into some questions that kind of rapid fire. There was one conversation I had last year with Mike Butters, who is the Tampa, assistant GM at Tampa Bay's in the hockey space for years. We're 2.5 hours later, and I'm like, Mike, we got to cut this off, man. Like, I can't edit this down to like 45 minutes or an hour. Let's go. But top 3 characteristics of great coaches, because you've been mentoring so many for so long. What would they be?
Empathy, the ability to build trust, and the ability to understand or recognize you coach individuals who are all unique, just like every other snowflake. You know, I mean, you don't lump them into one way. You know that kid. I have a drawing of a player front and back that I hand out. I learned 30 things on this piece of paper that kids fill in about who they are, their favorite color, their favorite number, their favorite music. And I need to know that kid. But then I do not coach volleyball. I coach people. And that's huge. So,
yeah, you nailed it. I mean, it's the whole connection piece, which that's the why, you know, and how you connect with those players is not really taught in the initial clinics that the coaches are taking. It's the, you know, the tactics, strategies, techniques, all that kind of stuff. So the evolution is how you're going to connect with those players to help them become the best they can be.
So I got to say something unique for me that's kind of happening right here in USA Volleyball. We're not a big company, you know, probably 50 people or whatever here, 40 people at this office. The two of the most recent hires are kids that I coached. And I didn't tell them to come to work at USA Volleyball. Each of them, the department, one is region services, one is high performance, Jordan, you know, they walk up and they go, how do you know John? And they each go, because they hadn't told him. Well, he coached me when I was 13. So what I would challenge your listeners, back to our outcome versus process, is to simply never be a child's last coach. That's my mantra in some ways. That's how I determine that you're a good coach, that you have 12 kids this season, and next season when they move on, every single one of them are still playing volleyball. I don't care if your record was 0-30. I care that every kid kept playing the sport and you didn't drive them out of it because of your coaching skill or lack thereof.
Yeah, I mean, with 70% of them, it's still a global statistic. It is getting better. I thought it was great in the U.S. When I talked to Bob Mancini, and he shared the anecdote where they were losing 60% of their kids before that high school age group,
right,
because of a whole bunch of reasons. And he said, what did you do? And he said, well, we focus on coaching development. We focus on the importance of fun. We focus on being a positive again. But the biggest thing that we thought made the biggest change is we got rid of our U-12 national championships.
Yeah.
Because all the parents were ramping up, all the coaches were ramping up, all the organizations, we've got to be in those championships, we've got to be in those fans. Once they got rid of that, it's like, okay, we can breathe a little bit. We can allow these kids to get to that development program at 15, 16, 17 years old. And now they're 92% retention instead of 60% of attrition. So it was a huge shift in that whole thought process. So
you're totally spot on. And what we have as an advantage is that an Olympic option and scholarships in the United States is doubles on beach. I mean, if you ask Karch how he got good, he played doubles. If you ask Missy May how she got good, she played doubles. My son's playing over in Germany for Berlin Recycling. I think he played 2 years of club, and the rest of the time he played doubles with me against men. He played doubles, and that's this huge advantage that is the real game. It's an Olympic option. So play doubles all summer, play doubles as much as you can, and it makes you a much better 6-on-6 player because you get the reps that you don't get playing 6-on-6.
Yeah, and one quick question, just touch on it. I talked to Martin Reeder in last year's summit, and he made it. He was on the Olympic team for Canada, beach volleyball. Can't remember 2000, which of the Olympics. And I asked him a question when he specialized, and kind of coming around full circle, I didn't get a chance to ask you, you know, what sports do you play as you grew up? But your passion on volleyball is unparalleled. When did you specialize, and when do you recommend that kids do specialize in the game of volleyball?
16, 17 years old, if they choose to at that point in time. One of the books that I'm going to tell everybody to listen to is Range by David Epstein.
I've been waiting for it to come out. Is it out on the bookshelves now? So you obviously got it. Yeah. I when he did the video with Malcolm, and they were talking about the book, and Malcolm goes, I made a mistake. I was like, oh, that was brilliant. Because I, like, ever since Outliers, I'm like, 10,000 hours. What if you do it 10,000 times wrong? Yeah. You make it permanent. So, yeah.
This is why generalists triumph in a specialized world. Okay. That is a book that I highly recommend, as well as The Culture Code, as well as The Talent Code by a dear friend, Dan Coyle, and his website. These are
must reads.
The culture is so important to move this healthy place that then, like you said, fun and all this other stuff, then the kids keep playing the sport with us.
So. What is your definition of fun when it comes to sport?
Being able to celebrate your successes and at the same time learn from your mistakes. You know, I love that one line that somebody came up with. We never lose. We either win or we learn. And again, that's back to learning. So for me, a fun place is where I'm learning new things, failure or not along the way. I'm not just stuck on the treadmill, you know, I'm learning new shots. A question for your listeners. Would you be a good basketball coach if you taught dribbling and shooting only with your right hand? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Would you be a good soccer coach if you taught dribbling and shooting only with your right foot? I don't think so. How much time do your volleyball players learn to hit with their non-dominant hand? And for the vast majority of volleyballers around the world, the answer is 0%.
Yeah.
Now, why is that important to me for this time together up with you? Over 75% of the knee injuries in the junior database are to the non-dominant knee.
Because they're planting on that. Yeah. Same thing in soccer.
For me, it's the antenna. And when I read the reports, when the antenna is there, which doesn't exist in most other sports, and you jump perfectly, you hit right-handed. If it's too far inside, you reach out right-handed. But show me, Glenn, for the sake of the fun here, what happens when you jump on the court, start to go up vertically, and then realize, oh, shit, it's past the antenna. What do they look like in the air?
Yeah.
They're huge tilt-a-thons that are tilting to hit it with their right hand, save it in front of their parents because maybe it's game point, and then what do they land on in a non-safe way? One-legged. Boom, their non-dominant knee. So Cody and my daughter Mackenzie and all the kids I work with, every practice spend 1 to 2 minutes non-dominant so that when the ball goes past the antenna, you, as a righty, you just reach out with your left hand and swipe it across. You're not hitting it, but you know how to use it.
Right.
Versus never teaching the other. And the other thing that cracks me up is your whole body legal in volleyball? Yeah. How long has it been legal? About 20 years. Well, how much time do you spend kicking or kneeing or chesting or, you know, heading the ball? And the answer is zero. Well, this came because you said fun. I find that fun to see if I can do these things with my knee. You know, I'm not a soccer player, but the whole body is legal. So I want the kid to have some idea of how to kick a ball up or knee a ball up or head a ball up or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that in many other sports where you're not developing the other side of the body. Like in baseball, mm-hmm. the best hitters usually are ambidextrous. They can hit right-handed or left-handed depending on the pitcher because it's all strategy. Well, I've got a left-handed batter coming up and you look at the analytics. Well, if he can hit both ways, it's a totally different can of worms. Mm-hmm. And them being a dominant right-handed or left-handed, then same thing with all other sports. So basketball, I mean, they got to be able to throw both ways and whatever. So you great, some amazing book references. I'm going to run to the store now and buy Range because I remember seeing John O'Sullivan shared it out to me about 2 months ago, and I was like itching the bits for come through. But any book references or resources that you'd recommend for parents because it's kind of a chaotic world for them right now?
You know, anything that any coach or parent reads on Wooden, and this one I love is because it's on leadership. A new coach and a new parent can't go wrong. But I would say Mindset by Carol Dweck and probably Grit by Angela Duckworth. And she just put out a blog that you may have gotten yesterday from me that was awesome about the summer of sampling, and that this is, you know, summers are for sampling.
I loved it. I actually loved it. It was great.
Hello, parent. That's what you should be doing with your athlete. Not more hockey or not more volleyball. Letting them sample and take a break and let their body, you know, kind of recover from all the moves that one sport does. I mean, the ADM side of this whole process for parents. Our website, we have 50 things that are going out to parents over the next few months at USA Volleyball that you can find. But it's all based on the team sports and the individual sports have gotten together at the USOC and said, these are things that parents should know. So we have a parent section with a lot of cool information on the grassroots, you know, USA Volleyball website. I actually, one of my best blog books that they're all free, but we compiled the first 5 or 6 years into a parent player book as a PDF free. And you can find that on the website. And that's specifically to a volleyball parent large about things that I thought really mattered. I still write to parents, but they're not in this one parent collection like I did.
Cool. So, and you've been blogging forever. Like, I remember when we were trying to connect with that mastermind a few years ago. When did you start blogging? Like, because I know the you're one of the predecessors for websites too with USA Blog.
Yeah, it was about 12 years ago, I think, that I started taking my thoughts into more of a digital way, in a blog way, versus writing books or writing a chapter and then sharing it. You know, all my books are free to download. The one that's the most important, I think, out there is Mini Volleyball, and it's out in Spanish, and it's also out in Italian, and it probably has 30 pages of crazy warm-up and cool-down games that are part of that non-volleyball world. Yeah. You know, because they're not volleyball players, they're people, and if you can develop their leadership and if you can develop their passion and their grit, you know, their perseverance. You know, I worry, Glenn, to see the way kids are able in social media to compare themselves to others so much more, and then the spike in the suicide rate, you know, happening here, at least in the U.S. And, you know, it's largely due to the fact that people compare and then feel short, and then they take this horrible route as an option. So, you know, for me, volleyball is a chance to teach leadership and this grit side and perseverance and all have fun at the same time.
Yeah, and life skills and all the other things that come with it. So last two questions. What can coaches do to shave 5 years off their learning curve?
Listen, you know, probably the number one thing is to go listen and learn from podcasts like this. This one is solid. Coach Your Brains Out is solid. Change the Game Project is solid. I don't know, there's probably a couple others out there that I mean, there's some others that I'm just not thinking of right now. The guy that did a great job on Coach Your Brains Out, but he has his own podcast, something about training champions or something. I don't know. Can't remember. But I've got about 5 podcasts. I have a lodge up in an hour away that's a veterans family, first responder families retreat center that we are training the women's water polo Olympic team at in a silent retreat, and all this musical instrument stuff we do for songwriting for the vets and their families, and it's an hour away. Well, a lot of the listeners are probably taking 15 to 30 minute drives to get to wherever they go. I'm listening to a podcast all the way up and all the way down. And the trip just flies by. And luckily, even without cell phone service, because we're up at 9,000 feet in this magical valley with 20 TPs and 5 cabins and a big lodge and surrounded by 500,000 acres of national forest. And you're welcome to come. Alberta was going to come with their whole staff, and then the budget cuts kind of hit and they had to stay in Canada and kind of come down to Denver and drive up, because we're only about an hour and a half from Denver and an hour from the Springs. So this learning opportunity for me at podcasting or listening to podcasts, I didn't know, because we have no cell phone service up there, that I can grab my phone, and even without cell phone service, it listens to, it can do, you know, the Siri or whatever translates your words. So I have the phone there, and when I see or hear, I mean, when I hear a line that I really want to remember, I'll either mark it based on the timeline on the blog, or else I'll say what it resonated with me. And while some of the words sometimes get out garbled, most, you know, your phone without cell phone service can still, is built in to translate, you know, what you're saying. And so I take notes without crashing my car. I think that's the most fastest way you can learn right there. You know, there's great books out there, but the podcasts are awesome.
Perfect. And then the last question before we wrap up, what can an organization or coaches do so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning?
Two things. Play more smaller-sided games within the program, even a queen of the court ladder fun things like that, where they get the reps. And that means in some programs, and it's in a video I did called Maximizing Net Contact System. When you go to a normal gym, there's six hoops up and they put up the net. So boys think that volleyball, girls, athletes think that volleyball is this kind of boring 12-on-12 game in much of the United States. There's a reason there's six hoops up in that gym. So when you do this rope on a wall with eye bolts and then run on the four nets on a rope thing that we use, or a ribbon all the way down the middle of your court, even if it's for 30 minutes out of a 90-minute practice, now everybody in the gym, even if it's a large group, can play one-on-one plus one, two-on-two, or even one against one, and get tons of reps. And I would urge your listeners to warm up always with 2 versus 0. 2 versus 0 means you and I are on one side of the, on opposite sides of the net. You serve to me over the ribbon. I pass it to the net. And as soon as you serve, you run to my side of the net to be my setter. To you, you set me, and as soon as you set me, you run to play defense on me because I'm hitting the third ball over the net. And after I hit the third ball over the net, I run to the other side of the net to be your setter. Six pairs of 2 versus 0, 5 minutes, you are thrashed.
Well, I'm going to say they're going to be gassed.
Everything you just did is game-like.
Yeah.
Everything you just did is reading. And none of it is pepper with no net. It's all over the net, and it's reality-based, because if you receive the ball and goes over the ribbon, I run to be your setter, and I have to run to the other side of the net to try and save it. But, you know, well, that's because you don't want to pass over the net. You don't want to pass to where it came from. You want to pass your side of the net. So we call it 2 versus 0. There's a thing of that. But it's this whole idea of playing small-sided games, even if it's only a 25-year practice, but the younger they are, the more it should be, tied into this following concept that I learned from both Japan and in Thailand in the programs I did for the FIVB there. You look up Lions Cup online, you will see elementary school kids in Japan playing at a higher level than most high schools in the United States or Canada.
Wow.
How do they get there? The sixth graders coach the first through fourth graders in doubles as half of their practice. So let's say a club has a 2-hour practice. For 45 minutes, you put the ribbon up, all the future kids, the little kids, or the 10s or the 12s come in, and the 13s on the first Tuesday of the month coach for 45 minutes with all these little kids. The next week, the 14s do it, not the 18s doing it. The 14s and 13s or the 12s are coaching these little kids. That which you teach, you learn. You'll be a better player if you teach, you know, coach. It just is. And so when you bring that down in a program so that your 13s, and it's only twice a month for 45 minutes, so it's not like it's a big deal, but it's also impacting the monetization, because the court is already paid for by the kids' parents that are coaching. The learning is happening, And so the little kids that come into this beautiful four nets down the middle of the gym or six nets down the middle of your court, these all these little small sided games, are being coached by a 13 or 14 year old, which is like, oh, I remember her when I was in first grade. She was like a fourth grader and she was so amazing, you know. The distance isn't there yet, you know, from an old person like me talking to a, you know, 12 year old. And so they remember, they relate better, and they teach it, and they become better players because they're teaching the future, and the future becomes really good because they get the reps. I hope that makes sense, but that's what I'd be doing.
Yeah, there's a program that I actually am hoping to have on the podcast. It's called More Sports, and they're a community-based model just in Vancouver, basically promoting soccer, basketball. They're trying to do a couple other sports as well. It's a multi-sport model. But they're, I call them campers, the ones that participated starting in like grade two or as a kindergarten. They end up then being identified to being like leaders for their camps. Mm-hmm. And then they then mentor them further to become coaches. So it's kind of growing them all the way up the model. And that way they can relate to the kids. They've been in the program. They know what it's beneficial to make it fun. So, and they've got 4,000 kids that come into that program year after year after year, which is, you know, testimonial, kind of bucking the trends of what everybody else is going through. So I can't thank you enough. And we kind of went a little longer than I imagine we could probably keep talking for hours. So I love the conversation and thank you so much for doing this. I can't even thank you enough. It's,
you don't need to.
Schedule and all the travel you're doing is crazy.
Well, the thanks really goes to you because you're doing all this work. I just had to sit and babble for a little over an hour or whatever. So thanks to you for making these kind of things happen.
No, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, and for loveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.